Lerato, I am thrilled, I am honored actually to have you taking the time for this. It's the first time, if I'm to be completely honest, that I am interviewing somebody who is so in depth in the arts arena. I'm usually more in the industrial sector and so forth. So this time I really wanted to have somebody who was a creative and being paid to be creative, because I believe we are in that era where creativity is no longer something that the arts people need to do, but that everybody needs to engage in. I was also quite happy because you have been in leadership roles, and this is something that I would like us to touch on as we go on. So I'm excited to hear about your entire profile. And with that, if I may ask you to introduce yourself to the people.
All right, sure. My name is Lerato Sokulu. I'm a radio DJ. I'm a script writer as well as a copywriter. I'm a content producer for television, and I'm an actor, but we haven't quite delved into that part of my career yet. So far, I'm known as a radio DJ and television scriptwriter and content producer.
Okay. You know, I was going through your profile, and in 2018, you were tagged as the alumni for the week, and I was reading that profile. And what really got to me is how you got into the arts. Because, you know, when I grew up, it was more or less something that was not discussed, but was known that I would not be doing arts. My father would not tolerate that. So that was already, crossed out from my career pathway. So I want to know what got you into the arts? You know, why are you so passionate about what you do?
Luckily, I come from a family of academics and artists. So from a very young age, my parents and my grandmother have always encouraged me to pursue the things that I liked. And then I found myself in grade 11, not knowing what I wanted to study. I hadn't applied anywhere.
Wow.
I had a very vague idea of what my future would look like. So I remember, I think it was a poetry competition with one of the prominent actors in South Africa. So I applied for that competition and subsequently won the competition. And then they gave me a scholarship to study business. So I thought, okay, I guess business is something I could try and do because, you know, they're going to pay for it anyway. And I told my parents. And my mom sat me down and she's like, look, we know you and we just don't feel like this is the right course for you. You'd rather think of something else before it's too late, but we really don't think you should be going into business. We don't see you in business. And rightfully so, because to me, had I taken that course, it would have been a role that I would have been playing. I wasn't thinking of it in terms of one day opening my own business. I was thinking, oh my God, it's going to be cool to dress up in a suit and carry a briefcase while going.
Yeah.
And so as I searched in myself, I had a boyfriend at the time as well who was studying at AFTA. AFTA is a film school in South Africa. And I was like, you know what? This school is one of those like private universities. Let me just tell my parents I want to go there and we'll see. And it's entertainment. I've always known that I love entertainment and I love the stage. So they agreed with their measly salaries. I actually don't know till this day how they managed to pay the fees because the fees were so high.
Wow. Respect.
Yeah. So that's when I really saw that they really believe in me because they were willing to sacrifice, you know, building their house and getting the cars that they wanted for me to go to this art school. And from then on, as the minute I entered or enrolled in the school, I knew that that's exactly where I should be and that I wanted to be in entertainment for the rest of my life. There is no plan B per se.
I love that. I love that. But did you know before, because you say the minute you entered, so when your mom was walking you through this, you know, talk and telling you, well, think about it, where were you at that moment in time? And how did the whole process look like for you to get to this is what's for me?
So obviously, because of, you know, our social background as Black people, especially in South Africa, I had no like real concept or idea that you could study anything in the arts. I didn't think that you could study acting or study graphic design or any of the art disciplines. And so when they pointed it out that, you know, business wasn't for me, I then started doing research into the different courses that were available to do that. And then I realized that, you know, this information, some of us are not privy to it. And our parents are still stuck in the mindset of you've got to be a lawyer or a doctor or, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah, one of those professions to make it in life. But none of them ever say, hey, do you want to be an artist? And because being an artist is hard.
Oh, yeah. I believe you. I totally believe
it's you. It's really not for the faint of heart, because after I graduated, I think I was jobless for about 2 years. And within a year, I started volunteering at a community radio station. And that's when I really understood what it meant to be a creative and had a picture of how it was going to work out.
Mm-hmm. That's deep. That's deep, because being jobless for 2 years and still sticking to your guts, that's remarkable. Lerato, can you walk us through, because I want to, you know, envision with you how you were going through not just those 2 years, but to the point that you said you started understanding that this is actually what it means to be a creative. How did you come through that journey through the years, through your first jobs, if you can walk us through your career phase as an artist?
So immediately after graduating, the one thing my school didn't teach us was how to apply for jobs, you know. They made us feel like we were already made. They didn't tell us we would have to start, you know, just by being assistants or giving coffee to the producers, you know, in the productions.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, that was a shock, because I expected to enter the working force immediately after I graduated and land my first gig, and it wasn't the case. But then I also realized that the jobs that I was going for, then I was strictly into just acting and radio. And I realized that there was a lot of stereotype and typecasting when it came to somebody who looked like me. And the storylines were storylines that I felt were redundant and they were overdone. And I wanted to see something new creatively in television. So I stopped auditioning. And that's also probably why I didn't work for like 2 years, because part of the process is to continue to go to these auditions and put yourself out there. So I moved back home slightly depressed, because all my friends, you know, had really nice jobs and they were starting to buy cars. And here I was, degree and no prospects of a future. So I started going to gym. I started waking up at the same time that everybody going to work would wake up. That changed my life.
Nice.
Because then I stopped feeling like my life was on a standstill. I had something to do every day. So I would get up at 6 o'clock, I'd get dressed for gym, and I'd attend the 8 o'clock class or whatever. And then the gym had free Wi-Fi, so I'd go on the internet. And it was the time of Tumblr. Tumblr was really big then. And so that also became kind of a...
Is it still there, this Tumblr thing? Because I'm hearing about it.
That's where the real creatives are. It is.
Okay, forgive me.
It paved the way for Instagram. If you want to find more like pure art, I think Tumblr is the one. Instagram has become an influencer portal.
Okay. Noted. Tumblr it is.
So I started posting or reposting other people's art, and, you know, friends of mine that were around me at the time started asking me what I do. And I'd be like, I'm a writer. So I was able to get my first job as a writer for an online magazine where they wanted me to attend events and report back. And once I got that, I was like, okay, we've got something. So walking past this radio station, I decided to, you know, I'd put my CV there for an internship. I hadn't studied radio, but it's, you know, it's the same kind of medium as television. And after I handed in my CV, the big boss of the radio station received it. And he called me in for an interview. He's like, listen, your resume is the best we've seen, like, in this community radio station. Do you want to be programs manager? And I'm like, what? I was just like, I don't know anything about this. He's like, I'll give you a crash course. And the crash course was exactly like, it wasn't even a day. It was like 2 hours. And he was such a bad teacher, but he gave me the...
I hope he does not listen to this podcast because there will be problems.
No, we're on good terms. He knows. So he gave me a crash course and he threw me in the deep end. Here I was at 23, going into a role without experience, only a crash course of like an hour, and managing people that had been doing radio for years. All of them were older than me. I was the youngest. And unfortunately, my then boss had a reputation of using girls. And so that was the assumption that everyone had with me. And so when he announced it, and here am I, everybody also thought I looked like a lesbian. I had a mohawk. I totally didn't fit in the managerial position. I looked like a young kid, wet behind the ears, and, you know, nobody expected much out of me. But I was like, you know what? There's no way this man would put me in charge of this big role in his company if there wasn't something I could offer. And so I then looked at everybody's show and I assessed it and I came up with a content plan for each of the DJs. I think at the time there were about 36 of them. So which means I was creating content because radio doesn't sleep. I was creating content from 12 a.m. to 12 a.m.
Wow. Crazy.
After about a week of assessing the shows, I would visit each of the DJs and, you know, ask them to talk to me about their idea of the show and how I saw it move forward. I kid you not, I think only about 4 DJs really allowed me to come in on their shows. The rest totally dismissed me. They totally did not want to sit with me. They did not believe in me. And it probably was the best challenge and lesson I have ever learned in my career because I couldn't quit. I had my toe in the door. I'm in entertainment. This is what I want to do. And so I have to make it work. And there's this man who's tasked me with this. And if I fail, I'll really be letting me down and him. So I persevered. And I think within 3 months, they realized that I meant business. And the ones that didn't believe in me resigned.
Oh, that is the curve. Those who can't get it in, they leave. So, wow.
Imagine how I felt. I was like, whoa, I've just basically chased people away. They resigned to go to another station that was coming up at the time. And then we were left with the skeleton crew. And then I was in charge of, you know, replacing those people. And I had to find the right candidates. And that was hard because I'm quite a soft person. If you cry, I will believe whatever you're saying. And that's kind of a naive way or perception to have when you're hiring people. So I hired everybody. Yeah.
No, not Oh my gosh. When was this?
This was 2012, around September. Because people had resigned, I had to replace them. And my role gave me the power to hire people. Of course, I had to run it past the station manager, but ultimately, I had to find the talent.
Yeah. I understand. I want to know, just before you go into, you know, into it deeper, because you spoke about 36 people, right? We're only 4 in the beginning were willing to talk to you. What made you build up that trust to bring the rest, at least we're speaking of the rest who stayed, into your boat to trust you?
I think consistency. I was there every day, I was working hard every day, and I showed that I wanted to work with them, and I wasn't there to be, you know, someone that was unreachable or because I was in a position of power that I would just do whatever I wanted. I think my consistency is what won most of them over, because now they could clearly see that I had no sexual relations with the boss, and the boss had showed that he trusted me, and they had no choice really but to eventually trust me. But I think consistency is something that really, you know, proved to them that I was there for the long haul.
Yep. Understand. Nice.
So eventually I stopped hiring everybody. And we just worked, I think, for about 7 months. And, you know, we were getting a good response from the people. I even got in a bit of the marketing side of the business. I had to manage client expectations and meet with some of the clients. And lucky enough, it was the clients who also further made me believe that I was born to be in a position of leadership, because I'll never forget the one client. It was a lady. She owned a wellness clinic where she sold just wellness tonics and herbal stuff for your body. And she pulled me aside. She'd always been tough on me. Whenever she came to the station, I used to shiver because I'm like, oh God, here's this lady. She's, you know, no nonsense lady. She's driving a Mercedes Benz. She's got so much money and I'm so scared of her. And then one day she pulled me aside and she says, listen, I'm tough on you because I can see where you are going, and don't let these people here, you know, try to take advantage of you. You've got to be strong. And if you want to go where you want to go, you've got to be tough. And she kind of put me under her wing, even though she was a client. We built a really good relationship. From then on, whenever I had to speak to clients, they really listened to what I said. And I'm like, wow, I have an authoritative voice. This is great. And so from then on, I kind of filled out my role as well. I was more decisive and I trusted myself with the position. And so the station grew exponentially, and money-wise as well. I was bringing in clients because they trusted me, and I had a team that was scared of me now. So it kind of like...
It went from hiring everybody, the soft side, to this woman bringing out this element of toughness, assertiveness, and allowing you to walk into the role. That's nice. Okay.
Yeah. But also my boss became even tougher on me. Whenever I had one-on-one meetings with him, I would cry like tears down my face, because he was just, at the time I felt like he was breaking me down. I was like, why do you hate me so much? Why would you give me this position and be so tough on me, you know, when things go wrong? But looking back, that was the right thing at the time for him to do, because now there's very few things that can make me cry at work.
Have you ever cried in the office with your boss, or it was purely when you were outside after the meeting? I just want to know the dynamics, because this is something a lot of people speak about, you know, showing emotion in the workplace, to what extent one can bring that.
Oh, no, I cried in front of his face. I'm a sensitive person by nature. But it got to a point where I stopped crying because it wasn't helping. Whether I cried or not, the show had to go on. Work still needed to be done. So there really wasn't a place for me to continue feeling like the world was against me or having pity on myself. That had to go away if I was going to survive. So I eventually stopped crying, and we had a really nice working relationship for the rest of the year. He became a father figure to me, and he was someone, you know, that really mentored me and taught me how to navigate the world of entertainment, you know, with all the sharks and all the bad things that happen within entertainment industry.
That's lovely. I also like that you say that he became a father figure, which is something that I hear often of mentors. She became a mother figure, he became a father figure. I want us to touch on that as well, because I was reading that you did this show. I don't know if it's a show, if it was a small clip of F is for Fathers, where you touched on relationships between the daughters and dads. I would like us to just for a minute talk about that, because I feel our childhood, our upbringing is something that is so important in how somebody grows up and in also how somebody gets out of their shell. Because here you speak of three pivotal moments. One, your parents pushing you in the right direction. Two, this lady who was like, girl, honey, it's a tough world. Let's push and be tough and decisive. And three, your boss who became this father figure. So I want you to run us through a bit into that F is for fathers. What inspired that? And to what extent did it also shape where you are today?
Can you believe I haven't seen the whole thing?
What? I thought the producers see the entire thing.
he's a good friend of mine. So he wrote it, and the actor that he had gotten to play the role dropped out last minute. And so he gave me a call one day. He's like, hey, do you still want to do this acting thing? I'm like, yeah, I'll always want to do that. But, you know, I'm in the wrong city for that. And he was like, cool, here's a script. Mm-hmm. Tell me if you like it and if you'd like to jump on it. I looked at the script and I was like, this is such an important piece of work, especially because it didn't only cover the negative aspects of men not playing their role as fathers, but it also highlighted, you know, fathers that stepped up to the plate and, you know, fulfilled their mm-hmm. roles. And so it was just a cast of two. And I think I played or acted out about six different characters. It was different women from different spheres of life, all having different experiences of this thing called fatherhood. And so it was shot at the Playhouse. The Playhouse is a theater, one of the prominent theaters in Durban. And sometimes mm-hmm. we would have an audience, but it really was made for camera. It's like a docu-play. And it was from, he wrote it from real life experience.
Okay, docu-play.
Yeah. So he wrote it from different people's life experiences. But because some of the subject matter was sensitive, like there were issues of molestation, some of those people didn't want to be on camera. Yeah, so then we had to then play that out for him. So if you watch the film, he cuts to the people speaking about their dads, and then he'll cut back to stage where we are reenacting some of the stories that he had heard. But for him, it was mainly because he really wanted to advocate that there were men who were good fathers, that, you know, this thing of painting every man as a bad father is not accurate, because we are leaving out a whole generation of men who are playing their role. So I really liked his perspective on wanting to promote fatherhood, because it's always about mothers, and duly so. So I really liked that, you know, we gave a voice to, you know, all the fathers that have stepped up to the plate.
Absolutely. That's a brilliant one. You speak of your mother often in the beginning. You say that your mom is the one who had a talk with you. Just to know how your family setup was, is it something where you felt also, as you did this F for fathers, that your family, your mother, your father were also impactful, pivotal people in your life in such a way that it should be?
Yeah, so my mom fell pregnant at 17, so she didn't marry my biological father because there simply was no love. It was mm-hmm. one of those teenage love affairs. So she saw after she had me that it wasn't going to succeed. And then she met my stepdad, I think when I was about 4 or 5 years old, and they met in tertiary, and then they decided to get married. So I had two dads. I had my biological dad, whom I really saw because of the distance, but he was an active role in my life. I knew he was there. I knew I could go to him. And my paternal family was always present in my life. So I didn't have any resentment towards him not being there every day, because I knew if I needed to see him, I could do that. And then my stepfather really, really filled the void of not having my biological father present with me every day. We got really close and he loved me like his own. So I'm lucky then to, you know, have had a man that was not my biological father take the role of, you know, being a father and worked with my mother to raise me. And, you know, they were terrific parents. They would go out on a limb for us. They basically like selfless parents. So if they feel that you need something but they can't provide it, they will go out of their way to make sure that you get that thing. So I'm lucky that I have a really positive experience with a stepfather, which is not common.
That's beautiful. That's really beautiful. And you know why I touch on that? Because I have heard and seen that a lot of times the children who step up into leadership roles and are successful in them are also people from a younger age who are molded in that sort of way. And a lot of people do not see women as powerful. The word women and powerful sometimes for some people, and I don't know why, doesn't fit in the same sentence. And then people tend to think that it's a father figure that gets a woman to build up leadership. And I totally think that is nonsense. And, you know, that's why I was asking how your family setup was, because you stepped into a leadership position at quite an early age. And I felt that your parents were both quite pivotal. Your mother, who seems like a quite powerful person, the woman you met, your bosses were quite great in, you know, pushing you in that direction and allowing you to grow. I would want to know, what sort of skills have you developed from, you know, the soft Lerato moving from, you know, 2012 to now, 8 years later? What sort of skills have you developed? What are the top three you would say these are the must if somebody is to grow as a young professional stepping up into management, into leadership?
Sure. That's a tough one. My mom calls me a diehard, so we'll start with that.
Nice. Diehard. And you don't quit.
I think, yeah, so delving into what a diehard means, I think the top three things that you would need are resilience. Definitely resilience, because tough situations will be there. People will challenge you. Life will challenge you. You will be thrown into situations that make you feel really small. And if you don't have resilience, you will cower and fail. I think perseverance is another one, that no matter how difficult the situation is, you just have to continue. And my favorite saying is, the show must go on. If you don't do it, someone else will. So you've just got to persevere. And I think the last one is love. Love for what you do. Love for, you know, the people that you work with. Because I think the misconception is, if you're in a leadership position, you've got to be this rock that nobody can move. You know, you're just this bulldozer and your life is really strict. And I think that's where maybe we should really interrogate that. I've found that with my softness, I still can be tough. Being a soft person or sensitive person doesn't mean that I cannot be tough. It's just a matter of knowing when to be tough and when to be soft.
I love that.
But I always believe also in leading from a point of service. You must want to serve something, whether it's a team or, you know, whatever. But you must lead from a point of service. Therefore, if you lead from a point of service, at no time will you, you know, think that you own anybody or own something.
I love that. I love that. That's beautiful.
Yeah, you're not doing it for yourself. I think there's a lot of people in managerial positions, you know, why people hate managers is because they seem like a block, because, you know, they're not there to serve you. They're there to I don't know, boss you around. But I think serving and loving people, loving what you do, being, you know, persistent and being resilient. Yeah.
I love that. I love that because we're in an era where I did not, you know, for 1 hour, I always read Boss Babe, Boss Lady, Boss That. And then that's the image that somehow young people develop of a boss who's ordering people to do things that they want them to do. Whereas true leadership, really the love aspect, I love that. I love that. That is a core of what the future of leadership is. We're not anymore in that traditional sense where you had all these hierarchies and the fearful. Of course, there is another type of fearful, but the fearful way you were on your, you know, like really shaking when somebody who is a boss was coming into the room because you're like, what do they want now? And whereas love is the future. It is the human business is the future model. I love that. Thank you. I would, you know, now ask you some, I just want to know, who is Lerato? How do you navigate through your life? You know, so if you would tell us what has been the most challenging and embarrassing moment through your leadership, or powerful, just one moment where you're like, wow, that moment.
I think being fired was definitely the most embarrassing. This was my first radio job as a radio broadcaster. I wasn't in a leadership position, but being a radio presenter did put me in charge of, you know, the listeners that were listening to me. So in a way, I was in charge of, you know, what they were consuming. And so I started challenging my then boss because I felt like he was limiting me and limiting the show. And in my fighting, I kind of got demotivated and I stopped putting effort into my work and I went into autopilot. I became reckless with my job. I started drinking really heavily, and the environment also allowed that, because if you ever know anyone that works in radio stations, they'll tell you that, you know, they give you alcohol. You don't even have to pay for alcohol anymore.
Oh, why?
Yeah, because we go to all these events. We had a bar at work for, you know, whenever we have station meetings, you grab a drink and you sit down. You know, you have to do an appearance. You know, you ask for whatever you're drinking. Everything is provided for you. But it's obviously like your choice. But it's your choice to drink or not. But you know, we all used to drink. The only people that didn't drink were the religious people. But you know, so I started, you know, taking my position for granted because I couldn't come to some sort of an agreement with my boss about my future. But I also felt like he didn't believe in me, and I needed someone who was above me to believe in me and kind of be on the same, you know, have the same vision about my future or want me to succeed. And I just didn't feel like he was doing that. And so I'd missed a couple of shows. I'd been suspended, I think, 3 times. I think in the history of that radio station, there's no one that has been suspended more than me. I was horrible, horrible. So they fired me. And that was a really big shock because I was a hard worker. I was like, what? How could this happen? People always believe in me and, you know, they trust me with these things. But here we are and I'm fired. And to have to go back into the world, you know, I was splashed on the newspapers. You know, they said all kinds of things about me. I felt like it was tainting my reputation that I had built. And that was absolutely crushing. As a result, my parents stay in Eastern Cape. So I went to stay with them for a while, hiding from the world, because I was like, oh my God, I can't face the world after, you know, failure. Within 2 months of that, I got another offer from another radio station. And so the first thing I said to them was like, do you know that what happened with my previous job? And they were like, we don't care. If you do the job, then we'll take it from there. And then I had a boss who believed in me and gave me the creative freedom. He gave me so much freedom and I flourished. But, you know, what I learned from being fired was to respect your work. I think I'd gotten to a point where I didn't respect my job. I didn't respect my work. And that, you know, I own my part in that. And so this new position, it was so refreshing to, you know, then I saw that, okay, I can rise above something like this and rise above public humiliation. And I worked consistently, and that's when I got nominated for the radio show. And then I started getting really pompous. I was like, okay, we're back.
Let's rock. We're back in the game. I love it, though, because now we can laugh about it and you have those lessons that you learned. I hear some people who say, well, the word failure does not exist in my life. I have never failed. And I'm like, what? And then I understood the concept that they had a failure because it's the lessons that you take from the mistakes, and it's not necessarily something that you know, you're like, I am a failure. No, it's an experience, and I love that we are laughing about it.
Yeah, it's how you come back, because, you know, you are going to get knocked down. And I think the difference between someone who makes a success of their career is the person who gets up, who continues to get up after they've been knocked down.
What happened? So you are in this cloud nine, and you're like, we are back in the game. What happened after that?
So I get nominated, and I didn't even expect to get nominated because I'd only been on the show for 3 months. And I was like, whoa, that was an affirmation to me to say that, listen, you're in the right place. I'm always so conscious of being in the right place. When I say right place, I mean in conjunction with my path in life. All the jobs that I've had have to be in line with my bigger picture and what I see for myself as I grow. And if that job that I'm doing isn't in line with what I'm doing, then I'm going the wrong way. And I learned through being fired that if you have something deep in you that tells you to move from somewhere, or you start getting fed up or start getting uninspired about what you do, that is a whisper. Call it the universe, call it God, whatever you believe in. But that gut feeling that you have, you should always follow it. And I think leading up to me being fired, I had been unhappy for a while, but I didn't move. I didn't trust that get another job, or, you know, I didn't trust that I would make it. And so I stayed, and, you know, that blew up in my face. So with this new job, I'm like, okay, I'm in the right place. I'm in line. I really like what I do. The nomination came. So while I was enjoying this job, another offer came, but that offer was in Cape Town for Afternoon Express. It's a talk show on SABC3. So during the time where I wasn't working, I was just sending my CVs everywhere and nobody had responded. And up until now, then they were like, hey, do you want to come for an interview? We got your CV. And I'm just like, what? That's like 6 months later. Are you kidding me?
Talk about delayed action. Wow.
So really think, because I was like, I'm at a really great place in my career. I'm about to get the breakfast slot. And now there's this curveball that's been thrown at me that I have to, you know, it's also in line. And I really had to interrogate myself, and I decided to jump. I was like, okay, I obviously need to take a risk here, and I might fail or I might just soar. And so I resigned from the job that I was nominated for. And everyone was like, what are you doing? You were doing so well. Ah. Yeah. I resigned. And I resigned to become an intern. I had to start from the bottom again. So I resigned. I was an intern for 2 months, a non-paying internship in a city with no water.
Wow. How did you do your criteria list? What was your driver? But I love this because it shows it was really something that you must have thought was in line with your purpose, with your future. How did you come to that?
So I stumbled on statuses that I'd written on my Facebook 2 years before that. And all of them were me wanting to move away from the city that I was. I either wanted to go to Joburg or Cape Town. And I wanted to go back. I wanted to go back into television because that's what I ultimately studied. Radio was something that just, you know, fell on my lap and I happened to enjoy it. And so me choosing to move to Cape Town just helped me refocus again and say, okay, we've got this great experience now and we know how to do this, but the initial goal was to work on film and television. And, you know, this job, it wasn't even a job, this internship, I saw it as a gateway. I was like, this is one of those life-defining moments where I could stay and be comfortable in this job because I know I'd do it really well. Mm-hmm. Or I could push myself even further in order to grow, but also do what I really, really want to do. But it's going to require me to risk it all. So I resigned. I left home with my last salary and I stayed at an Airbnb for a year. But that was one of the best risks I've ever taken in my life. Because
nice, risk it.
Yeah, within 2 months, they were like, hey, you're really good at this. I'm like, yeah, I have like 4 years experience in content producing. and so they hired me. I had two roles. I was a scriptwriter and a content producer. And then eventually I dabbled in account managing. The one thing that I learned then from that is that, you know what, I could do whatever I put my mind to it. And really, the main thing for me is to grow. The jobs that I have resigned from, it was because I felt like I did everything that I came to do and I learned everything that I possibly could have. And there wasn't going to be any more room to grow. So yeah, that's a defining thing for me in any job is that how much can I grow? Have we grown? Can we still grow?
Yeah, I love that. I really like that. Can we still grow? Yeah. Have we grown where we have been? Absolutely. If, Lerato, you had, you know, if money were not an object and you were guaranteed to be successful, what job would you do as a career now in 2020 going forward, given the whole circumstances that we're facing as a world?
That's such a tough one because we obviously have to consider Corona, which really, which for me has been difficult because my work has now stopped because my work requires gatherings. And it's seen as a non-essential service, which I find absolutely terrible because we're all here consuming entertainment. So it definitely is an essential service. What the hell?
Absolutely.
I think I would do the same thing. I would be a writer. Well, I started doing comedy as well, but that was stopped by, you know, the circumstances we're under. But I think I would be doing the same thing. I really don't see myself doing anything else other than writing because storytelling is what I'm passionate about. I love stories. I love hearing stories. And, you know, I believe that the world of books and the world of, you know, storytelling really opens up your mind. It allows you to travel even if you have never boarded a plane. We all started traveling before we really, really traveled. And it opens up your mind and, you know, it changes perceptions. Storytelling has the power to shift, you know, a whole culture and a whole people. So I think I'd be doing exactly what I'm doing now.
Nice. That's so true. I mean, the storytelling has so much power. That's true. Going to the current issues, right? I'm not well versed in the South African current issues, but what are the most important current issues that you are facing, potentially also other young people, young professionals are facing? How are you dealing with that, at least the top one? Let's not talk about Corona. I think Corona's like, please, not me. Not me again. But it doesn't matter. It could be Corona. I don't know. It could be that.
The issues right now, I think, are ownership of our ideas. Because up until maybe a few years ago, all the production companies were owned by white people. Mm. You know? And there's very few production companies, so you really had no choice in the matter. But now we've started to mm-hmm. see young Black creatives, even older Black creatives, open up their own production companies and owning their ideas. Because for so long, mm-hmm. we have given away our ideas for jobs and, you know, because of the political climate, the economical climate, you know, we've always, you know, allowed other people to or fed into other people's dreams. So I think now the fight is ownership and doing your own thing, especially as a person of color. We're in such a beautiful space in South Africa. We are seeing young Black designers making a name for themselves under their own labels. We are seeing musicians, you know, doing music exactly how they want to. And it's really shifting the entertainment industry, because now the big corporates can't bully us. And, you know, the people that have been in power in these production companies for years are now having to work with us. And they are realizing that, you know, we're not willing anymore to work under them because we are just as great, if not better, as they are. So I'm all about owning your ideas and reaping the full benefits of your creative mind, because there's a lot of exploitation that is still happening, that has happened within entertainment. I think the young Black creative is the most exploited person. But because you want a job, you take that exploitation. But we're coming to a point where young people are fighting back, and that's all because of the internet. We now have the world at the tips of our fingers. And, you know, that's a really great tool, where now I don't have to count on a big broadcaster to have a radio show, for instance. I could have a podcast. I don't have to wait for a big magazine to publish my work. I can open a blog. I can, you know, so I think the challenge now is owning our ideas.
Absolutely. I love that. I love that. Because, you know, I was sitting with my uncle another day, and he was saying, you know, Claire, Black people or people of color are so tuned in to working, to jobs, to going 9 to 5 somewhere and getting a paycheck. And we don't speak, like you say, of these, you know, ripping the full benefits of owning an entire process, or owning our ideas, owning who we even are, and speaking about wealth. Because you can't be building wealth on something you do not own. So that's powerful. That's really, really, really powerful, mind-blowing. Let's own our ideas. And there's so many platforms to do that now.
Yeah.
What would be your last takeaway message? I heard the ownership part. We also heard the three things that you advocating for if you want to grow in leadership: resilience, the perseverance, and the most important one, the love. What you do, love the people, serve the people. What else would you give us as a takeaway message before we close?
That's again a tough one, because I'm kind of navigating my new world now, and you know, it's really a tough time for, you know, careers like mine. But I think continue to find inspiration, continue to be inspired. Mm-hmm. I think that's the only thing that's going to, well, that's one of the few things that are going to help us get through. And, you know, because we've got to get through. But I think the saying that has been replaying in my mind on days where I really feel down is, "This too shall pass." I know it's corny.
It is true, but it will pass.
I really believe that, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, if we can approach life or approach happiness and sadness with the same kind of feeling, we're much better off. But I just think continue to be inspired, because I think once you stop being inspired, you know, that's when you are unable to dream anymore. So continue to be inspired, whatever is inspiring you, and go out of your comfort zone. And even if you're not into art, try to understand a different medium. Try to involve yourself in things that you don't understand, And yeah, keep being inspired to do more.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for that. Thank you for your time as well. Appreciate it. Have a lot of things to reflect upon what you touched upon. And honestly, today is an aha moment, because it doesn't matter what career path you take, creativity is something required across all platforms, resilience across all platforms, love across all platforms. So in essence, we don't have careers to divide us, but to learn from each other in all the different pathways that we take. Thank you so much
for the platform. I think it's really great, and I've been checking out your page as well. It's so well put together. That's why I thought she was South African.
Listen to her now. Like, it's gotta be a South African. It's well put out.
What?
Thank you.
It's so like, it's on point, and I don't think I actually have seen a platform that's so well put together. So well done on you too. It's a really great platform.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay, have a wonderful Saturday. And I hope we make it out on the other side.